Now, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up to the mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. And blessed are the pure at heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and say falsely and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Today, as we walk through the Beatitudes, we're asking the question, what does it mean to be blessed because you are merciful? 31 times in the New Testament, the authors of the New Testament refer to acts of mercy. They use mercy as a verb. To have mercy on someone, 14 different times. To obtain mercy or to receive mercy, 8 times. To show mercy, to have compassion on another, to have pity on someone, to have mercy, in other words, to possess it, to have mercy upon someone, and then to receive mercy. All throughout the New Testament, mercy is spoken of as a verb, something that we do. We give and offer mercy. But only twice is this verb changed to an adjective in which it describes someone as merciful. The first is in Matthew chapter 5. We just read it. "Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy." But I think the power in only mentioning it twice as an adjective comes in the second mentioning in Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 17. "For this reason, he," Christ, had to be made like them," meaning us, "fully human in every way, in order that he might become merciful and a faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people." The power of understanding what it means to be a merciful person, a person who acts mercifully towards others. First of all, it's an understanding that it takes action on our part. Mercy, if just contained in our head, is not sufficient. We have to be able to act out that mercy. That's the whole point of mercy in the New Testament, is that it is a verb. It is something that we do. But we do it in a unique way because Christ set the example for us. We do the work of mercy just like Christ did the work of mercy. Because he took on human form and became like us, human in every way, so that he could be merciful and be a faithful high priest. To put it in modern day terms, Jesus chose to walk in your shoes. He chose to understand what it was like to be you. Jesus chose to take on human form, all of its frailties, all of its weaknesses, all of its challenges, all of its joys. He chose to take on human form so that he himself could be merciful. And in like fashion today, my challenge for us is that we must also do the same in order to be merciful. We must be willing to walk in someone else's shoes, to learn what it is like to be them, so that we can then, in turn, display mercy. From God's perspective, when Christ came and dwelt among us in human form, God allowed the Trinity to experience what it meant to live as a human being, as one who was created. Yet remember, Jesus didn't surrender his divinity. He didn't surrender the mind of God and come and live in as a human form. This was not a smoke and mirror show. Jesus was still fully divine. It's a mystery. I don't get it. I don't understand how that can happen. But in Jesus' understanding, he had the full mind of God, but yet also had the full experience of being human. And in doing that, brought those two together in a singular experience we call the incarnation, the moment in which God dwelt in human flesh. And it wasn't God just slipping on the form of human flesh and not really experiencing what it meant to be born. Not really experiencing what it meant to learn language. Not really experiencing what it meant to weep at the death of a friend. This wasn't God kind of pretending on our behalf. Jesus experienced the fullness of humanity. And so Hebrews tells us that. So the tears he wept at Lazarus' grave were real tears. Even at the moment that he was fully divine and knew that there was life after death, even as he raised him from the dead, he knew that Lazarus would once again visit the tomb. He took on human form. Part of what my invitation for us as we understand this beatitude is it's one thing to be merciful, but it's a far other thing to then know that we will in turn be shown mercy because we are merciful. And that's not so much about who's going to show us mercy. I don't think this is just about you will show me mercy if I am merciful. But I really think this is about God saying, and I will show you really what mercy means. Because if anybody needs mercy, it's me. Me. If you don't believe me, come walk a mile in my shoes. With the Apostle Paul, I raise my voice in saying that I am chief among sinners. If anyone needs to be shown mercy, it's me. And part of it is understanding that we can understand each other by being merciful. I listened to these prayer requests today, and I thought about this as we shared. We can be merciful for Donnie as he talks about a dear friend and a respected colleague and someone in his life and in his work family who passed away. I can be merciful. I've walked in those shoes before. I can be merciful with Jennifer. I can understand the pain of watching children tossed about in a system that seems to not really understand what it's doing. I've seen that. I've gotten to know those families. I've gotten to know that family. I don't have to have taken drugs to be merciful towards someone who is addicted. Because I myself know what it is to be powerless against my own weaknesses. I can be merciful. But can be and am are two different things. The challenge for this beatitude for us is, will we move from understanding mercy to living mercy? And in order to do that, I believe there are four things that have to happen in our life. First of all, in order to be merciful, you must first be humble. This was the whole point of the passage in Hebrews, that Christ surrendered his rightful place as the throne and as the Son of God living in infinity. And he chose to place on himself human form and live bound by time and death like you and I. He was willing to be humble, to lay aside everything that he had on our behalf. So we too, in order to be merciful, must be willing to lay aside our perspective on things, our preconceptions, our prejudices. We must be willing to lay aside the things that we see and see things through another's eyes. We must be willing to understand how another feels by surrendering our own preconceptions for this moment. We can learn that by listening to the stories of people around us. I don't know what Angela's really experiencing with the loss of a job, but I do understand this. A single parent trying to take care of children, it can be pretty easy to get lost in the chaos of doing all those things right. And if I didn't have anybody teach me, it would be even harder. If I had no example before me, how difficult would it be for me to not only sustain my children's lives, but also my job? And how quickly I could get confused. I have never been through that, but that doesn't mean that I can't understand the challenges of someone who is going through that. I listened to my own daughter's story of being a single mom, and how challenging that can be at times. In order for me to be merciful, I must humble myself for not always having the right answers. And I must humble myself and see things through the eyes of another. I've never been homeless, but the power of Colin Carter's story several weeks ago about trying to find shelter from a thunderstorm inside of a car he broke into, and that's what got him arrested. And to be thankful that he was arrested in Johnson County because he was able to meet Dennis and then turn around and go through a program and learn something and gain some sort of resource, to be thankful for that? I've never been thankful for something like that. Doesn't mean I can't take myself out of my position and ask the question, what would it be like being that person? When we are humble, we can be merciful. Second thing we have to do is we have to remove our lens. I see through these glasses that are, they are not prescription. I bought them at Walmart in a value pack for $12. There are better ones out there. They're more expensive and I'm cheap and I lose them all the time. I've gotten smart because now I leave a set of glasses at each place that I tend to need glasses. So what happens is at some point when I come home and I have two sets of glasses on my head, I realize I've got to go back through and figure out where I have a gap in my glasses, deposit a set of glasses, and I'm back to, I can operate that way. I see my world through a 1.25 lens. That's how I see my world. I put on my wife's glasses. I can't see anything. I'm guessing I couldn't read using Carol's glasses. Carol can. I have no clue what Paul sees through his glasses. Not going to work.
Don't even try.
I'm not even trying. Look at all the people in this room that have glasses on. Even sunglasses. We each see our world through a set of lenses that helps us see it the way we need to see it. Here's the difference. if I turn around and give these to one of my daughters who don't need glasses and tell them to read and see their world through this, it'll give them a headache. You know why? Because their eyes don't need this. Could you imagine walking around in Paul's glasses all day long? Donnie, you'd probably lose a finger at the workplace. Or more.
Or a brain cell.
Or a brain cell. I mean, nobody wants a brand new Ford with a finger in the door. No.
Custom leather.
Custom leather. Could you imagine if Dennis wore Paul's glasses welding? He might get scorched pretty often. Think about how our lenses help us to see. But when we turn around and try and make other people see the world just like we do, it doesn't work. The reverse is also true. If I turn around and try to see a world just like you, it won't work. At some point, what we have to do is take off our lenses, our glasses. We have to take off the way we see the world and be willing to look through another's eyes. This, we could go down the rabbit hole all day long on this one, but one of the things that I thought I would print off are a few questions from what are called adverse childhood experiences. Kaiser Permanente, probably, I think it's been almost 2 decades ago, did a giant study. What they noticed was there were certain people coming into the office with diabetes, cancer, you know, all kinds of physical ailments, heart disease, all of these things. They came into the office and they started noticing in their charts some consistent patterns in their childhood, things that had happened to them. And so they asked the question, I wonder if something that happened in people's childhood predetermines what their health would be or can predispose them for certain health conditions. So they did a study. Understand, this wasn't a study, like often we hear about studies of like 1,000 people, and so they give you all these results. They ended up studying the records of over 10,000 at that time in the Kaiser Permanente system. And here's what they found out. If a parent or other adult in the household swore or insulted or put you down or humiliated you or acted in a way that made you afraid, if so, you have one strike that you are more likely to be predisposed to a serious health condition later in your life. Did you often feel that you didn't have enough to eat? That you had to wear dirty clothes, that you had no one to protect you, that your parents were too drunk or high to take care of you? If so, there's strike two. They went through this and they asked 10 different and created 10 different markers. I have worked with people who have scored a 9 or a 10. You know where I meet them? Johnson County Corrections. I meet them when I'm doing strengthening families for kids that are currently in care with KBC. I meet them doing juvenile programming. The point isn't to turn around and shame anyone for these things being either a part of their own family or the family before. But the point is that sometimes when we encounter people that can't make right decisions, that tend to always eat the wrong thing, that aren't going to do something that they need to do for their health, that you know you're sitting there looking at them thinking, why aren't you doing this? This makes perfect sense. To understand that in their life and in their pattern, that things have happened in such a way that they don't think the way we think. Because we didn't grow up in a place where we had a workplace with a family. A family at your workplace? That Paul can share prayer requests and testimonies and that they get together in a room upstairs and they actually have times when they can just walk around the place. And even though Paul doesn't like it, he knows that the culture is one. The culture is one where people choose to take care of one another. we have to be willing to remove our glasses and ask, what is it that you see the world as so that I can better understand, rather than telling you, put on my glasses so that you can see it my way. Then we can have a relationship. Blessed are the merciful, for they will take off their own glasses and look through the eyes of another. Blessed are the merciful when we step outside of our own understanding. Some of these things make no sense to me. When we understand how another feels and how another sees, it doesn't work for me to understand how they act the way they do. I don't get it. But yet, we have to understand that in our world, there are rules that exist that we know nothing about. One of the books that I've been reading, and I've read it and I've now reread it, is it's called A Framework for Understanding Poverty, and it's a cognitive approach. In other words, why do we think the way we do when people live in poverty? What about the middle class? What about those who are rich? In this book, one of the things that I love about this is it gives you a quiz. And this was the first time I'd ever heard this quiz. Could I survive in poverty? Do you know which churches in town have the best rummage sales? Do you know which restaurants throw out food and at what time of night? Can you entertain a group of friends with just your personality and stories? Do you know where all the free medical clinics are? I don't know that I could survive living in poverty. But listen to what it's like trying to survive in the middle class. Do you know how to get your children enrolled in Little League or piano lessons? Do you know how to order at a nice restaurant? Do you know what it means to talk to your children about going to college or a trade school? But what about those who survive in wealth? This was fascinating. Can you read a menu in three different languages? I'm going to be hungry as a wealthy man. During the holidays, I know how to hire a decorator that will have appropriate themes for the items that I already have to decorate with. I know how to enroll my children in preferred private schools. Or for some, I know who to bribe to get into preferred private schools. It was fascinating as I read through this. I realized that I am the child of a middle-class family. And the only ways that I have learned some of the things that I have learned is I have moved from my preconceptions and understandings, and I have tried to learn what it is that people who are living in poverty need and how they function. I haven't learned it all, but that's one of the things that I've done. I've learned how to be a bridge. I will be honest with you. I have never taken the effort to learn what it's like to be a bridge to the other side. I had one of my coworkers that said to me, Lee, maybe you're just supposed to minister to the upper class. And that was when we were at a church that was a very affluent church, and we were starting another congregation in a very affluent part of town. And they just told me, because I kept pushing against this, why are people like this? And her idea was, we just need to learn. She had figured out how to build that bridge to people who had 50 times my income. 50 times my income. I admit, I never really learned how to do that. But I have learned to do it the other way. One way is not better than the other. That's not what I'm saying. But I am saying there are hidden rules and things that when our mind works a certain way, we have to understand it works that way because of the way we were raised, because of the environment we were raised in. When we choose to be merciful, we have to surrender that and learn how others function and why. And finally, the fourth thing we have to do is we have to accept others without judging and teach without expecting. What do I mean by that? I can look at the lives of the people that I work with, like it's strengthening families. And I know that every one of those children have been removed because of substance abuse in the home. I can work with them. I don't have to judge that. Judging has already been done. That's why I'm working with them and their families. They've already been down a path of, they have a lot of stuff that they got to do to take care of this. My job then is, I don't need to judge. What I want to do is I want to come into that situation and I simply want to serve and I want to teach. But I don't expect anything in return. I am willing to simply teach. And here's the power of God that I recognize in what I do. Is that it's not my job to get results. That's their job and God's job. But it is my job to be faithful and teach. Dennis, I remember way back, we were still in the school and we had had several welders that had just kind of exploded and blown up and things were frustrating and it wasn't going well. And you had shared that with me at the beginning of church. And as I stood up, we added as a part of the prayer request that we needed to pray for these welders. It wasn't going well. But I reminded us as a church, our job is not to expect outcomes, but our job is called to be faithful. To be faithful. And maybe today I would modify that in terms of what we're teaching is our job is to be merciful. To be merciful ones. Who go out and take the gifts that we have. And even at times when those gifts are simply walked on like they're somebody's dirty carpet. But to understand that we are called to be faithful. And that requires something of us. From this point, we go out and we will head to our families. Our families, every one of our families in this room, every single one of our families in this room have individuals in those families who need mercy. They're different than us and we don't understand it. They act different than us and it's confusing. They do things that are different than us, and it can be frustrating. But every time I try and help them simply see it my way and learn how to do it my way, I am met with frustration. And so the call of this beatitude is, blessed are you, merciful one. Blessed are you. You will be shown mercy, perhaps by those that we're showing mercy to. Or perhaps it's from a God that looks at Lee Jost every morning and says, I don't get why you make the same mistakes over and over. But today, we'll start anew.